Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for dropping along tonight at the Sydney Institute, folks, for our discussion on absolute power, God, belief, and the Pope. And we have two speakers, Dr. Paul Collins, who's, I'll introduce him briefly, he's well known. He's a historian and broadcaster with degrees from Harvard and the Australian National University. He's the author of many books, including The Birth of the West, and he's here on the occasion of the launch of this book, Absolute Power, How the Pope Became the Most Influential Man in the World. And Paul Collins has worked as a religious commentator for the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, for the BBC, and for PBS. He makes a welcome first appearance here. Dr. Margaret Somerville makes a welcome return. She is Professor of Bioethics at the at Notre Dame University in Sydney and an author of a number of books, I suppose, most recently, and this is what she spoke at the Institute about, Bird on an Ethics Wire, Battles About Value in the Culture Wars. Now we're going to start off with Paul Collins, we go to Margaret Somerville, and we go to question discussion. Paul Collins, off we go.
Well, I want to begin by thanking Gerard, not only for the invitation to speak here tonight, but also to thank him for bestowing on me the Five Paws Award, which he himself says is just below the Nobel Prize and equivalent to the Academy Awards. The award was bestowed for defending on the ABC's AM program Archbishop Philip Wilson's right of appeal, which was being questioned, and I also spoke of his good record in dealing with sexual abuse issues, particularly in the Diocese of Wollongong. But, Gerard, I am disappointed, because you seemingly miss my other statement concerning the now former Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull and his intervention demanding that the Pope sack Wilson. When asked by an ABC journalist about this, my response was, who does Malcolm Turnbull think he is? King Louis XIV? Gerard, surely that's worthy of another five paws. So that'd be 10 paws, 2.5 dogs. Now to the topic of papal power. Now, I'm a long-term practicing Catholic. I'm regularly asked, do you go to Mass? The answer is, yes, I do, every Sunday, and sometimes listen to some appalling sermons. Now, I know it's an unfashionable stance to say you're a practicing Catholic these days, and I'm the first to admit that Catholicism is rife with contradictions. Perhaps the most disjunctive of these contradictions is the contrast between Jesus, the poor man who had nowhere to lay his head, as the Gospel of Matthew says, and who died like a common criminal on the cross, contrasted with the popes from the early 12th century onwards until 1978, who were crowned with a tiara of three crowns and addressed as the father of princes and kings and the ruler of the world. Pope Innocent III, of course, died in 1215. He was quite sure he was at least the ruler of his known world, which of course was Europe. Since Pope John Paul I in 1978, this ridiculous anachronism has been abandoned. But the reality is that, in fact, the popes of the later part of the 20th century and the first part of the 21st century are probably the most powerful popes in the entire history of the papacy. And I say that as someone who has written a book some many years ago about a general history of the papacy. I mean, the reality is that in papal history, papal power has ebbed and flowed. And if you went, say, to 1799 at the end of the French Revolution, Pius VI died in the citadel in Valence in southeastern France. His body lay unburied for some 6 months, and he was simply referred to as Citizen Bracci, which, of course, was his name before he became Pope Pius VI. So the papacy was at the rock bottom. The intellectuals of Europe said the papacy's finished. They were all very proud of that. And now, today, 220 years, give or take a few years later, here we are, with the papacy in many ways more powerful than it's ever been in the entire history of Catholicism. So how did that come about? Well, before I answer that question, I want to say a number of things that I think are very good about a profoundly and widely influential papacy. One of the examples that I actually use in the book, you'll all remember the tension between Cuba and the United States, which lasted, of course, from Fidel Castro's revolution. A resolution of that occurred in the Obama presidency between Raul Castro, Fidel had gone, and the Obama presidency. The key person who negotiated that was Cardinal Pietro Parolin, the present Secretary of State, inspired by Pope Francis with his profound recognition and consciousness of the Hispanic world. Canada certainly played a role in that reconciliation, but the papacy was widely recognized by both Castro and Obama as playing a pivotal role in that reconciliation. So I just choose that one example to highlight the importance of the papacy in international affairs. One of the questions I'm regularly asked is, why do we waste money on an ambassador in the Vatican? And there's a very simple answer to that. We do that. We don't waste money on an ambassador in the Vatican. It's a very good place to be. It's a listening post. It's a place where people talk to each other off the record. It's a place where people can have meetings that often have very good repercussions in international affairs. The next thing I want to stress, and it is a very modern phenomenon from Pope Leo XIII onwards, is the papal tradition of social justice. It is probably, in many ways, the thing that has most impact on students who go through Catholic schools these days. The thing that I discover with younger people talking to them is that it's the social justice tradition of the Church which they have picked up. They may not be going to Mass, they may not be saying the Rosary, they may not be particularly pious, but they have certainly picked up the social justice tradition of the Church. So I see the papacy quite positively, but at the same time, I think there are some problems built into it, and I want to talk about both of those. Now, the title of the book is Absolute Power. The term does not come from power tends to corrupt, absolute power corrupts absolutely. The comments of Lord Acton in his review of Mandel Crichton's book on the Renaissance popes, it doesn't come from that. It comes from the definition of the First Vatican Council of the primacy, the primacy of the Pope. The Pope has supreme and absolute power over the whole Church. So that's where the absolute power comes from. There is a real problem using the word power when you talk about anything in the Church, especially in the light of the New Testament, because again there is a contradiction. Like every Christian, the Pope is a follower of Christ. And Jesus says that the essence of his community is not power, but service. You have his imaging that at the Last Supper in St. John's Gospel, where he washes his apostles' feet. If you look at, for instance, chapter 10 of St. Mark's Gospel and the parallel passages in the other synoptic Gospels, Jesus says that power is identified with the Gentiles, which is a New Testament word which specifically referred to unbelievers and idol worshippers. So there really is a kind of an ambivalence within Catholicism. Catholicism is full of ambivalence. That's why I love it. That's why it's actually quite livable for a human being, I think, because it lives with ambivalence. We are often criticised for living with compromise. I think ambivalence is a better word than to say compromise. So what the book does is it looks at the history of the papacy from 1799, death of Pius VI, and it takes it right through showing how the papacy has recovered from rock bottom, truly rock bottom, probably the worst time in papal history. There are a couple of bad periods. The 10th century was pretty awful, where the papacy was controlled by the mafia-like clans who ran Rome. But how the papacy recovered. And there are a number of elements in that recovery, and I'll just touch on them. I won't talk too much about them, but I'll just touch on them. In the 19th century, coming out of the Romantic movement is a movement. You can't call it theological, because it isn't theological. It doesn't come from theologians. It comes from Romantic French thinkers, people like de Maistre and Chateaubriand, after whom the steak is named. I've never worked out if it's a sauce or the steak or the cut. Some of you can tell me afterwards. But it came out of this romanticising of a desire for absolute truth, a desire for absolute certainty. And in a way, that's what ultramontanism is about. It comes from the Latin ultra montes, beyond the mountains. There was an equivalent movement, which most people have never heard of, called cisalpinism, which is the other side of the Alps. That's over on the northern side and the English side. But ultramontanism essentially comes out of France. It comes out of the recovery of the church in the 19th century. It spawns an enormous number of devotions. Many of the apparitions at Lourdes, for instance, are part of the ultramontanist movement. And it finds its peak in the definition of papal infallibility at the First Vatican Council. Now, it's probably a mortal sin to admit this here, but I'm actually a friend of Hans Küng, and I think Küng is wrong on a number of things. I think he's right on quite a number of things as well, but one of the things he's wrong on is that the most important teaching of the First Vatican Council in 1870 is papal infallibility. No, it isn't. Papal infallibility, because they knew about it, it is so well hedged in that essentially the Pope can only teach what the Church believes. He can't make up doctrine. The most important definition at Vatican I, because it slipped through without anybody noticing, is primacy, papal primacy, which essentially hands the Church over to the Pope lock, stock and barrel, has absolute authority throughout the Church. Another thing that happened in the 19th century is the papacy gained control of episcopal appointments. Most people think that the popes have been appointing bishops since Jesus. They haven't. It's only in the 19th century that the papacy got control of episcopal appointments, but that means that the pope at the time can make sure that the episcopates of the world reflect his priorities. And the key thing that I think that has made the papacy most powerful, nothing to do with theology, nothing to do with the church, modern communications. Innocent III, the gentleman I mentioned earlier, could fulminate in Rome as much as he wanted, but it took a while to get to Scotland. It took a while even to get to Wales. let alone to Scandinavia, because modern communications didn't exist. John Paul II understood this as perhaps no one else in the 20th century. He understood modern communications. He understood that he used television brilliantly. But he also understood that presence was important, especially in less developed cultures like Africa. And so that's what all of the tripping was about. It was about being present. Medieval monarchs understood that. The German emperors, for instance, Otto I, he had this constant tour around the Ottonian kingdom because the monarch was present. And so papal trips were about that. So it's all part of that centralizing tendencies. And so all of that, I talk about all of that in the book, and you may want to tease out some of that a bit later. I want to get to our contemporary friend, Francis. And I just want to make a few comments about him, and then I'll finish. I'll tell you what he gets, what he understands, what got into his head. He understands the Vatican II, the Vatican Council II's teaching on the church. He understands that the essential teaching of Vatican II is that the church is the people of God. He understands that the community and the local church are, if you like, the primal church. What Karl Rahner calls in German the Ursakrament, the primal sacrament. He understands that the Catholic Church has got to move in the direction of synodality. It's got to, another big word to say, it's got to develop synods. It's got to develop more, not more democratic. I'm not promoting democracy here. I'm saying it's got to promote synodality. It's got to promote synods in which all of the members of the community participate. He's understood that clericalism and the Tridentine seminary system, the seminary system that came out of the Council of Trent, are now toxic. The child abuse crisis, in many ways, goes right back to the formation that I include myself because I was a priest for 33 years and I went right through the seminary system. I must say I got a very good education, but not every priest did. The kind of clerical caste is born in the seminary. And that Tridentine seminary system, I think, has now become quite toxic. Francis gets it that pastoral care prevails over ideology. That's what all this stuff about, you know, his discussion of gays, the stuff about marriage, communion for remarried divorced Catholics. He gets it that pastoral care is the key thing. I mean, I'm sorry, but that's what I learnt in the seminary pre-Vatican II. We were told, and it was schooled into us, that you are there to care for people, to support people, not to condemn them, not to give them a hard time. Perhaps that was the religious order I belonged to, the Missionaries of the Sacred Heart, and we were always known as an order that had a pretty gentle approach to people. He also gets it that the church is no longer and can no longer be Eurocentric. Again, if I may refer to Karl Rahner says that the great 20th century theologian, the Jesuit, says that the key thing that's happened is that the church is now a world church. It is no longer just a European church. And Francis gets that. He also gets Catholic social justice tradition and gobsmackingly gets the environmental movement in Laudato Si. I've been tied up with greenies. You know, I'm a kind of a half-wit, left-greeny kind of wishy-washy type. So I've been mixing with greenies and environmentalists for a long time, although they have driven me mad because the children have taken over. Francis actually gets it on the environment. Let me tell you, and he also has at last got sexual abuse. It's taken him to a couple of months ago to get it. And I the present attack on him over the McCarry case, I think, is a complete beat-up. Let me conclude by saying what he doesn't get. He doesn't get women. He doesn't get the role of women. It's in many ways, I suppose, it reflects his Argentinian background. It's, you know, a patriarchal Latin culture. Mind you, a lot of us Western, you know, Anglo blokes don't get it either. And as is clear in Laudato Si, he doesn't understand the kind of the reproductive health population kind of issues that face the world today. And I think that that's linked to the fact that he doesn't get women. Let me conclude by saying, yes, the Catholic Church is in deep trouble at present, very deep trouble, and we're only at the beginning of it, I'm sorry to say, folks, not at the end, because what we're starting to see now is the sexual abuse crisis moving to Africa and to places like India. However, if I may be a little triumphalist to conclude, I believe that while in the Western Church we might have a lot of problems ahead of us and that the Church might become a good bit smaller, I have no doubt that Catholicism will survive because the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. And I actually believe that.
Many thanks, Paul. Collins and Robert Tumble.
Thank you, Jared. Well, I received a text message and it said, "Did you get my email? We'd like you to talk about God." Now, there was no indication on the text who'd sent it. So I went through my email and searched under the word God and found Anne Henderson's email asking me to participate in this evening's function. My first thought was, I'm no expert on God. I'm not even a theologian or a historian like Paul. I am, however, a bioethicist, a member of a relatively new profession of applied or practical ethics, who are the latest group to be accused of playing God. They seem to have taken over from doctors in doing that. And that brought to mind that old joke, which probably most of you have heard, that there was a new arrival in heaven and he asked St. Peter, who was the man rushing about in a white coat with a stethoscope around his neck? And St. Peter replied, "Oh, that's God playing doctors." Well, and it made me wonder whether perhaps these days God is playing bioethicists. Ethicists are also sometimes described, often with some hostility, as the moral police. That characterization tells us that ethicists exercise power and authority, and like the Pope's power, this is soft power. That is power exercised through persuasion and influence, in contrast to hard power that exercised through coercion, such as military force or economic sanctions. Francis describes soft power as causing people to fall in love with Catholic moral teachings rather than convincing them to fall in line. And I think that's a brilliant description of the difference between the two sorts of power. But whether soft or hard, power and authority must be exercised ethically, which raises the issue of what that requires. Interestingly, there is almost no research or literature specifically on the ethics of ethicists. And sometimes people get mad about that with me. They say, "Oh, you're always telling doctors what to do. Why don't you look at what ethicists should or shouldn't do?" Now, Paul gives us some insights in his book into the ethics or otherwise, a lot of otherwise, of popes. So one way to view the Pope's soft power might be that he's seen as the chief ethicist of the Catholic Church, and his power comes from being respected as such, including by many people who are not Roman Catholic or even religious. Francis, as Paul just told you, focuses on areas such as social justice, poverty, homelessness, the plight of refugees, those harmed by war and violence, especially children, and protection of the environment, where we're likely to find agreement on right and wrong, ethical and unethical. That is, we can find some shared ethics. Now, that's enormously important, finding a shared ethics, in, at least in some areas, as it allows us to participate in an experience of belonging to the same moral community. It allows us to start from where we can agree on what our values are and what ethics requires, rather than focusing just on our disagreements, as is so often the case. Moving from where we agree to where we disagree alters the tone of the discussion that surrounds our disagreements. That discussion is less hostile and more mutually respectful. Francis also gives strong emphasis to the role of individual conscience, which helps people to see those with whom they disagree not as the enemy or evil, but as sincere people just with different values. Indeed, we often depersonalize and disidentify from those whom we treat in a way that we would not want to be treated ourselves in order to treat them that way. Torture is a prime example of that. Indeed, so is killing in war. But you have to disidentify from the person to be able to do that. And so hate for the other person results from our failure of imagination in being able to see them as a person. It might also be that soft power has limited hard power, or even in some cases displaced and defanged the latter. When you were talking, Paul, I wondered if that might have been true of the Cuba resolution. Communications technology, as Paul told you, are the instruments of soft power, and they operate on a global scale with almost instantaneous connection and involve huge numbers of people. Counting just Catholics, Francis has over 1 billion followers. What other world leader ever has had over 1 billion followers? This is why he is so enormously powerful. Unlike hard power, soft power tends to be non-hierarchical, where we go back to what Paul told you about putting the church in the control of the lowest level of the people in the church. And although soft power can be used tyrannically through naming and shaming, attributing guilt by assertion and not proof, emotional tyranny and so on, and we're seeing some of that with our communications technology, soft power also crosses boundaries that are impermeable to hard power. And young people in particular are forming online groups to exercise soft power, whether to save the honeybees from neonicotinoid insecticides, exposed slave labour situations in cheap clothing factories. I suggest they feel a compatibility with Francis and even see him as a leader. The Pope is primarily a religious figure, and postmodern Western democracies are often described as secular societies. So is there a paradox in the Pope being such a powerful intellectual figure? That depends on what the term secular societies means, which raises a wider issue, namely, what is the proper role, if any, of religion in the public square? In particular, in informing public and social policy in such societies. In secular societies, most people support every person's right to freedom of religion. That is, the right to choose your own religion and not to have a religion imposed on you by the state, or to have a state religion. They also support freedom for religion. The state must allow the practice of religion within the law and not interfere in purely religious matters, although it's starting to do so, which is a huge worry, and there's going to be major rows about that in the future, particularly in the courts. In the last 20 years or so, however, there have been strong claims by secularists that there is a right to freedom from religion. That is, religion should have no voice in the public square, and the views and values of religious people, whether lay or clergy, should be excluded. The flaw in this argument is that everyone, including secularists who argue for the exclusion of religious voices, has a belief system, a worldview. Indeed, secularism is a secular religion, And in a democratic society, every voice has a right to be heard in the public square. It is wrong to exclude religious voices as it would be to exclude secular voices. The big values divide in our Western societies at present is between those with conservative or traditional values and those with so-called progressive values. There are major differences between the two sides, although in fact there are multiple camps, not just two sides, but it's convenient to talk of them as two sides. Progressives tend to focus almost exclusively on the individual person and their right to autonomy and what they want, and they take into account only what will be the impact of their values decisions in the present. I call that presentism. In contrast, while conservatives also take into account impacts on individuals and in the present, they look as well at what history, collective human memory can teach us and what warnings our collective human imagination can provide with respect to future consequences of the values that we adopt and the laws we pass or actions we engage in, especially in relation to ensuring protection or otherwise of the common good and of vulnerable people. There was a magnificent speech in the Senate of the Federal Parliament about 10 days ago by Senator Pat Dodson, the Aboriginal senator, and that was and the legislation unexpectedly that would have allowed euthanasia in the Northern Territory ultimately was defeated, and whereas beforehand we were told they had no chance, the anti-euthanasia had no chance of winning, but it did by two votes. And what Senator Dodson did was look to the past and say, look what happened to us. Look to the present, what situation are the Aboriginal people in now, and look to the future, how will this euthanasia be used in relation to us as vulnerable minority people. And absolutely, I really recommend strongly to you that you go online, you can find it. It's a really, really magnificent speech. Now, I'm a big believer in First Nations people's wisdom, and for us in Australia, that's the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. They regard their values as present through time, past, present, and future. They look to elders past and present, and they also often invoke elders of the future. I would suggest that the papacy, which is currently personified in Francis, also represents this wisdom travelling through time approach and is one basis for the power of the papacy. Popes are seen as leaders of a community of faith travelling through time, right back to the Hebrew story. Another factor contributing to the Pope's soft power is that people are longing for an experience of transcendence. The feeling of belonging to something larger than themselves and that what they do matters to more people than just themselves. Most people used to find that experience in religion. Today many look elsewhere and very often they can't find it because we need to bond with others to have this experience. Religion, the word religion comes from re ligare, to rebind together. Francis's pronouncements have made many people, both Catholic and non-Catholic, who otherwise felt excluded, feel that this bonding is possible for them. Nowhere is this more manifest than in the huge crowds that attend Francis's weekly public audiences in St. Peter's Square. I was actually there a few weeks ago, and I had the good fortune to actually meet the Pope, and he's amazing. I mean, he's totally charisma on two legs, he really is. And he, he marches around that square. He's an old man. He's picking up the babies and holding them up in the air. It's absolutely extraordinary. I would also suggest that Francis's power comes from his being perceived as a person of integrity and not tainted by corruption, as sadly many leading world figures are. He's seen as humble, kind, genuinely humane and empathetic. Francis is not working for his own aggrandizement or to attain selfish goals, but for the welfare and well-being of others, especially the weakest, most in need, most vulnerable of our fellow human beings. I was walking down an aerobridge bridge to board a plane recently, and there was a poster, and if I remember correctly, of all things, it was advertising the HSBC Bank, not a good place to be these days. The poster had a message promoting respect for animals and a quote from Francis that said, "They are God's creatures too." It brought to mind what an extraordinary reality and gift all life is, and a theme I've been working on, that science and religion are not in opposition, but are complementary. I suggest that Francis helps many people to see that, in part because he's joyful about creation. He's not pessimistic, and he's joyful. If we view the knowledge that science opens up with amazement, wonder, and awe, and we avoid cynicism, we can experience hope and act ethically. I call it the wonder equation. It's AWA minus C equals H plus E. Amazement, wonder, and awe minus cynicism equals hope and ethics. And Socrates said, and I only found this out yesterday, I didn't know Socrates said it until yesterday, even though he said it a long time ago, he said that wonder is the first step towards wisdom. So I suggest that so many people respond to Francis because he makes hope and ethics seem attainable. And if you were a Catholic, you would see this as the working out of the Holy Spirit's master plan. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So I'll get Paul and Margaret to come back up. As I said, we've got copies of Paul Collins' book published in New York, Absolute Power, How the Pope Became the Most Influential Man in the World, and I'm sure Paul will be happy to sign it after the event. And now we come to questions and discussion. I'm going to walk over there, so one of you go this side, one of you go that side, a bit early, but anyway. Margaret, you've absolutely shocked me tonight. I mean, this suggestion, I'm trying to get over it, that the Pope's got more followers than President Trump is. I suspect it's fake news, actually.
It is.
Can we start off with Paul? There are a lot of people here, we've got to be brief. I guess the most misunderstood stuff about the Pope today in Western societies is the concept of infallibility. I mean, journalists invariably get confused on that one. I mean, a commentator on Sky News said she couldn't understand how the previous pope resigned because he was sick, because he was infallible. So, you know, so there is confusion. So I think the last infallible statement was probably in the 1950s, was it? So just give us a brief background on infallibility. And if you come up here,
right,
talk into that microphone, and then I'll get over.
I must confess, firstly, that you've got to take my theological view on infallibility as a minimalist view. But it is an informed view from reading of the sources of the First Vatican Council, which defined infallibility. Part of the reason why I think there is this enormous confusion about infallibility is because subsequent to the Council, the notion of infallibility really took off. And there really is a sense among a lot of people, a kind of a primitive caricature of infallibility, that anything the Pope says is infallible, you know. Essentially, the First Vatican Council teaches that the Pope speaks for the Church. While Pius IX, the Pope at the time, wanted in many ways to stand over and against the Church, the Council actually brought him back into the Church and said that when the Pope speaks ex cathedra, that is, when he says, "I am now speaking authoritatively and infallibly," then that is the binding teaching of the Church. But the Pope can't just make it up. He has to consult the bishops. He has to consult the Church as to what the Church believes. The Pope can't declare Mary the fourth person of the Trinity. because he had a great devotion to Our Lady. It has got to be what the Church believes. In Pius XII, the very thing you referred to, Gerard, in 1950 with the definition of the Assumption of Our Lady into heaven, body and soul into heaven, he consulted the bishops. It was a council that declared that bishops, a group of bishops meeting in ecumenical council, that declared the Pope infallible. So papal infallibility is quite hedged in. And the minority bishops at Vatican I, who opposed papal infallibility, out of 700, ballpark figure, 700 bishops present, probably 200 opposed it. But they 200 made sure it was well hedged in. You've just got to be careful about it. I mean, people have just caricature infallibility, and what they say is nonsense.
Right, so just speak into it.
A question of both of you. I recently witnessed a diatribe at a conference by a Muslim professor that had been granted amnesty in the States, saying that the Muslim religion would take over. I did a wiki search and found out that apart from Catholicism or Christianity, the second largest religion is in a country that really is a country with no religion at all, which is called Chinese folk religion. It's 22% of the world as opposed to 34% Christianity, 12% Muslim. Could either of you explain to me exactly what Chinese folk religion is?
It might be a bit off the topic, I think, but you know anything about Chinese folk religion?
No.
No, essentially. Well, I mean, what is interesting about China is that it's not so much folk religion, it's the advance of Christianity. Underground Christianity in China is quite extraordinary, mainly Protestant, mainly evangelical Protestant. But it's absolutely, I've seen all types of figures, but I've seen 100 million or more Christians in China.
I have a controversial theory that because religion is so widespread throughout human history that we actually have a genetic base that points us towards needing religion. So if you try to wipe it out, then it comes back in some other form, and I would suspect that's what it is. And I have to be very careful with this because I'm not promoting what is called genetic reductionism. That is that my genes made me do it, and it's only a response to some genetic prompting. But I would describe it as being like the genes. I like a television set or a radio. If you don't have a television or a radio here, you can't tell what's on the radio or what you could see on the television, but you've got the equipment to receive it. You can receive it, and you can choose different programs. I also happen to believe, because there's a whole new area of science called epigenetics, and we know that those epigenetic changes, the genes actually can physically change through environmental stimuli. And we know that those are often time-limited abilities for that. It's called imprinting, or it's really the other word for it would be activation of that gene to occur. And my theory is that the Jesuits were right, that you have to get a kid before they're 7 years of age, because after that, probably the gene for reception of religion has shut down. Now, this is just hypothetical on my part, but boy, it causes problems when I say it often, because I've had people coming to me practically in tears and saying, I didn't discover religion until I was 21, so is there something wrong with me? And of course, no, there isn't, but I think it's very complicated.
Thanks very much. In contradistinction to what you just said, I gave religion away at 21. And when I was studying philosophy at university, they called the pursuit of something to believe in solipsism, and maybe we're just rebranding it or calling it something else. But I'm interested tonight because I'm part of this sort of generation. I might be on the, hopefully I'm on the tail end of this generation. But I heard nothing about the relevance of the Catholic Church in particular, because you're talking about the Pope, or the church in general, to the younger generation. And as a father of five, starting from 26 going down to 8, the church is totally and utterly irrelevant. It doesn't feature in their life. It's not part of their communication. They don't understand God, as I understood it when I was going as a server in the church and whatever. It sort of amazes me. It sort of amazes me that we can have these wonderful nights, and I'm interested in this because I'm 56. But my 26-year-old or my 23-year-old wouldn't be here.
All right. Okay.
I just make it pretty good.
Well,
part of my theory is that we also need to have some radical change at a certain time to abandon our childhood appreciation of religion and to grow into a maturity in it. So you might have been following the normal path. You might have needed that. And it's a matter of where it goes on from there. But I think a lot of people have that experience of going through a period, often in the middle of their life, where they don't follow the religion and then they re-find it later on, but in a much more mature way. Paul?
Look, I think you put your finger on an extremely important point. I'm not so sure if I disagree with you or not, Margaret, but I mean, I think that the evidence, the statistical evidence is that increasingly now they're not coming back. I mean, it used to be, when I can remember when I was a parish priest of Randwick, it used to be they'll come back at... Well, bless you, my son. Up with that crowd. That's up the street from Our Lady of the Sacred Heart. But the evidence is they're not coming back. But we always say they come back in marriage. I think what the point that you put your finger on is, and this is a thing that is increasingly being discussed in the maintenance of Catholic schools, in Catholic education, and that is, what are we trying to do? Are we trying to get pious little Catholics to go to Mass on Sunday? I don't think that's what essentially, because we're not going to get that. But what we are doing is we are forming imaginations. We are forming a view of life. We are forming the way in which people perceive reality. The American sociologist Andrew Greeley, a priest in the States, quite grumpy and difficult character, he's dead now, so I can say that safely. But he's the one who introduced this notion of a Catholic imagination, what he calls the Catholic imagination. That's what I see in a lot of younger people who have been to religious schools. I'm seeing them with a view of life which involves social justice, which involves responsibility to the community, which involves care for the environment, which involves looking out for the people who are marginalised. That, I think, is what we're doing. That's not filling the churches, that's not filling the pews, and that goes, I think, to another deeper problem of the very rhetoric, language, and the way we even talk about religion, but that's a whole other topic, and I don't want to go into it here.
Yeah, I think the other thing that backs up what Paul said is that in the last census, something like 80% of the population said they were spiritual.
But except I don't want to get caught on vague spiritual. You know, I go into the bookshop and I look for the, you know, books on this, that and the other thing. I'm talking about a much more formed, real thing. It is not floating around in a miasma down at Bondi Beach.
Thank you both for your paper. Margaret, this is a question primarily to you, but I'd be interested in your thoughts too, Paul. Margaret, the Pope's recent comments on the death penalty and potentially changing the catechism could have far-reaching effects. As an ethicist, how significant do you think this is?
I have long argued that you cannot be against euthanasia and pro-capital punishment. You have to be consistent. The only reason that you are justified in taking human life is to save human life. And originally that was always the case. that you could only kill if somebody in self-defense, if that was the only way to save your life or those you had to protect. If you looked at the rules of so-called just war, it was only when you did it to, you were not the aggressor, you did it to save life. If you looked at abortion, it was only allowed to save the mother's life. And you looked at the death penalty, it was thought that people who'd killed once would kill again, and therefore that was justified too. It wasn't correct, but it was justified on that basis. So I think it's absolutely fantastic that the Pope has come out and said that. And I cannot imagine how people can be present at public executions.
Margaret, it was more the principle.
Well, hang on. We've got to move on, but he's saying it's more the principle. But I thought you covered the principle. So.
No, it's the principle of change.
Principle of change?
Look, I think we'll go up here. Okay? No.
I was interested in your comment, Paul, about the church becoming non-European, the Catholic Church. And I've got a little bit to do with numbers of Africans who've come to Australia. And a young woman who lived with us for about 3 years, who's sort of become part of our family. And my grandchildren down in Canberra, who've been in Catholic schools and don't go to church very often, are now... Well, the little seven-year-old wants to go to church. She doesn't know the meaning of the word mass. Mass doesn't mean anything to her. Her father's not a Catholic. But at that Narrabunda parish, they have a mixture of African, Indian parishioners who do a most fantastic, lively, whatever. Now, in my experience with the African Catholics, they're much less locked into the notion of what we saw as Catholic Church of Rome, whatever. Yeah. And they're much more fluid in their idea of celebration and worship.
Yes.
Is there a time in the future when, with a more global Christianity, we reverse Luther and go back to the one? Or is Rome just too powerful for that?
Well, look, I think that the church, and you know, I kind of enunciated it as a principle, Anne, at the early in the piece, that it's a shift from a hierarchical, centralized church to a community-based, local church. You're absolutely right about liturgy that African people, Latin American people celebrate. It's much more lively than kind of the Anglo-Australian variety, which is deadly dull. One of the interesting realities for Catholicism in Australia, and if you look at the statistics, and we've got quite accurate statistics on this, our mass attendance at the present moment would be 10, I think it's less than 10%, but 10% is an optimistic figure of those people who report on the census that they're Catholic. Mass attendance figures would be catastrophic if we take out Filipinos, Indians, Sri Lankans, Africans, and Asians. It would be catastrophic. And so that, and this is actually something George Pell said many moons ago, and I disagreed with him at the time, but I think he's right now. And that is that the Australian church is fast becoming it's always been a multicultural church. But it's fast becoming a non-Anglo church now.
So there's a question up here.
Paul, you gave us a thesis that the Pope is now the most powerful person. But my question is to Margaret, because Margaret, you gave that assent to such great approbation, and you gave us some examples of why it's good to have such an authoritative figure who has such power to work for good. But hasn't the child abuse scandal, right across the church, right across the world, hasn't that exposed the real weakness of having such authoritative figures who are unaccountable, who can use their power or misuse their power to cover up evil? Isn't the whole notion of such authority under enormous pressure now?
Yeah, well, that's what I talked about, that, you know, that power can be used unethically, evilly, wrongfully, and that's a very good example of it. But I don't think you can label everybody as a wrongdoer because there were wrongdoers. You know, that I think that's so sad, and particularly for the people who've, the priests and religious, who've devoted their lives and haven't been involved in anything like the horrible sex abuse scandal and didn't know about it, you know. But you're right, that some of the people in authority, they were very misguided, that they thought they were doing the right thing. They had a, really what I see is the bottom of it, that they had a misplaced loyalty, that their loyalty was to the institution and keeping that as sort of esteemed as possible, knowing that if this came out, you know, people would be rightly horrified. And they didn't perceive their obligation to, as the Pope put it just a couple of weeks ago, to the little ones. He said, we abandoned the little ones. Terrible. But, you know, these things happen.
I just want to pick up one word you said, accountability. It's a very English word. There is no word in Italian for accountability. There is a word for responsibility, or responsabilità, but there's no word for accountability. And responsibility is different to accountability. Yeah. Accountability is that you have to answer for your jurisdiction, if you like. You have to face up to it. And what I think we're struggling with at the present moment, especially in the Anglophone world, is that that is simply part of our view of the world. You know, we know we're accountable. Our leaders are accountable, but it's far less accountable in the Latin world in many ways, and so. We've somehow got to help the Italians, and I don't know about Spanish because I'm not a Spanish speaker, but help the Italians at least, and possibly the Spanish, to get a word for accountability and then to do it.
Time for a final quick comment or question.
Yes. Sorry, just a question for Paul. You mentioned some of the things that Pope Francis gets and some of the things that he doesn't get, which I think included women and reproductive issues, and he's likely getting the abuse matter. Does he get the need for a married clergy? I think this is a question related to some of the other questions, because it seems to me that not only a drop-off in numbers of people going to Mass, but obviously the number of clergy.
Yes.
And we're relying a lot on imported clergy. Some of them are who are married. Does he get that? Is he likely to get it?
Oh, he gets it. The problem is the bishops don't get it. He's already offered. He says, come to me. If bishop conferences come to me, I will seriously consider the ordination of married men. He's already said that. He's made the offer. The English bishops formally said, no, we're not. Now, you know, what planet do they live on? The Australian bishops will... I think they live on Uranus, because they just don't get. There is a terrible fear built in somehow, but it's not Francis in this case; it's the bishops.
Yeah, could I just comment on that? One of the things I left out of that paper I gave is that there's a surprising number of young Catholic men becoming moral philosophers and moral theologians and getting married. And my guess, it's total guess again, is that they will probably be these people who will in the future be ordained, because they'll already be married. It won't be any different from somebody coming from the Anglican Church. And they've got all the qualifications. And they're all, not all of them, but I'm working with a whole lot of them, really, really impressive young men doing moral theology, moral philosophy.
Why do we have to wait?
Okay. Okay.
I seem to have lost control tonight because we tend not to have interruptions and interjections. we're a higher standard here. We have a no riffraff rule, you know. Okay, so many thanks to both of our speakers for a very stimulating discussion tonight. As I said, Absolute Power got copies of Paul's book. Margaret's book we sold when she was last here. But... there'll be important papers to publish in the Sydney Papers Online, which Anne will put out soon. We'll range across a lot of issues, from history going back centuries to really the whole debate going on today. So many thanks to Margaret.
Thank you.
And well done, and many thanks to Paul.
Thank you.
And good luck to your book.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.